You worked in a Category A prison. What are some of the craziest stories you have from this experience?
Well, that's a great place to start and probably one of my favourite jobs that I have ever had, to be honest. And it was the first job I had when I came out of university as well. So let me think, what are some of the craziest experiences I had there? So I had lots. So I was a drug worker, drug and alcohol worker in that period of my career. And my job was to look after and try to connect up prisoners with services out in the community and hopefully offer a bit of advice and guidance on the way. And so I had a lot of clients over the course of the time I had that job. You'd see 4 or 5 people per day. And I suppose some of the things that were surprising in that job was a mixture of, there were people in the prison at the time who were very much treated prison as an occupational hazard. So they were very kind of chillaxed about the fact that they were back in prison again. And they were like, well, I'm a burglar, so this is what happens every now and then. It just goes with the territory. And actually, it's quite nice because I don't have any bills to pay for a couple of months. And I had one or two experiences because it was a Cat A where my client might be an actual Category A prisoner. So I had one young guy who was in for murder.
Wow.
And when I was trying to connect with him, I asked him, you know, what that experience was like and why it came to pass. And he was in such a, sort of state of fury and hatred for the world that he told me that the reason he'd killed the person was because he wanted their trainers, which I don't think is what it was, but it was certainly slightly mind-blowing at the time for my career and my experience of it. So yeah, that would be one. And then was another client who I had very briefly was a well-known Colombian drug dealer who clearly was in control of other people in the prison, and it wasn't a particularly pleasant experience talking to him either.
And were there any points during that career where you felt like in danger or threatened? Was it not?
So prisons are, and certainly my experience was that you were very, very well supported. You had really great training. We were very lucky, which is we had a prison officer in our team who was very experienced and was really clear about what you would do if you were in a slightly more vulnerable situation. We had keys. We weren't in uniform or anything because we were a civilian staff, but we had quite a lot of training about not being conditioned by the prisoner, which basically is when it's a little bit like grooming, basically, where they try to befriend you and try and kind of get you beyond their side. And so having kind of boundaries and knowing where they are is a really important sort of basic protection. And also there are, you know, buzzers and alarms everywhere, and all of the rooms have got windows so that if you're in a room with someone, it's very clear who's in there with you. And you just get trained with basic things like you always sit nearest to the door, for example.
Yeah. I'd assume that quite a high percentage of those inmates were narcissistic and psychopathic potentially. Were there any ways?
They're normal people. I mean, there's people with personality disorders or mental health conditions, of course there is, but the vast majority of people, even in a Category A prison, and the prison I was in was a local prison as well, so it's mostly guys that had slightly rubbish life chances and who had either sort of fallen into the wrong crowd or that was their way of living their lives and financing their lifestyles. And of course, a lot of people, they were in there for shoplifting, burglary, etc., because of their drug problem or their alcohol problem. That's why I was chatting to them in the first place. So it was surprisingly rare that you would meet somebody who was a genuinely terrifying individual. It was quite formative for me because it helped me understand that the vast majority of people under the surface are good and kind, and the actions may be abhorrent, but usually the person is not.
Okay, That's really, must have been a really interesting revelation, because I would just thought category A prison, bunch of psychopaths, bunch of narcissists. Yeah.
No.
Oh, wow. Wow.
Yeah. That's... I mean, obviously a mixture, and some people would have been in a very, very high. So in the prison I was in, it was a high security prison, but it had an additional prison in the center of it that was the even higher security area, which we didn't go into. But it was relatively few people in there, and it was an area where you would go if you'd been causing problems in the prison community, basically.
Yeah. And what are some success stories you've had in your career? Are there any memorable people you helped turn their life around?
Well, I wouldn't go as far as to say I should turn their lives around. I think they had turned their lives around, certainly. I had lots of really great experiences working directly with clients, some of whom went off and, became involved in the recovery community, moved into employment. Quite often the people that you had continued to be in touch with were people that ended up working for one of the charities that I was working for at the time. So lots of really great examples of people getting their lives back on track and coming into it, either a voluntary role or a sort of peer support role or a job, a paid job over the course of time. And those are some of my sort of favorite individuals that I can kind of still picture in my mind that did really well. And I was maybe a person that they connected with on the way, but I think the credit is the person that did the work, because there's a lot of work involved. You have to change a lot of your life choices if you want to move from a position of having a really problematic relationship with a substance to not having that anymore. And you often have to change your entire social circle. You have to change your aspirations, your goals, your outlooks, your ways of responding to tough and challenging situations. There's a lot that goes into it. So very impressive. And I often feel that it's not really acknowledged the level of bravery, determination and persistence that people that have really moved everything in their lives, we should be more, like there isn't anyone more responsible and dependable than somebody who's done that in their lives, basically. So it's really compelling, and is why it's such great work if it's your thing. But I also, the people who I remember are the people where it didn't go that way. And so the people sadly, the people who I can picture more clearly are often the ones who didn't make it and who passed away. I had a number of clients that were on my caseload that died at some point or had been on my caseload and then later weren't and died. And it's, again, for a job, being a drug and alcohol worker is such a rewarding job, but you do need a decent level of support around you from your employer, from colleagues, from family, because it's very demanding emotionally. And again, having those boundaries is really important.
So what inspired you to pursue a career in helping others with addiction, especially in regards to alcohol?
A number of things. Partly it was my first job, and I think my experience with my first job out of uni was that this was a group of people who didn't necessarily have, there was literally no respect from the rest of the public about their health challenges that they were having, and people were often treated really in quite atrocious ways by the general public. And one of the things that I particularly found inspiring and always have about people with drug and alcohol problems is it's a challenge that can be overcome. So as a younger person, I'd worked with the elderly. I'd done some work with people with learning disabilities. But the possibility of people sorting themselves out and turning their lives around is really quite compelling. So it was that, really, more than anything else. But like others in life, I have got my own personal experiences in the background in terms of watching and seeing, particularly alcohol use. And I grew up in hospitality, so I saw a lot of people drinking more than they should, and and not necessarily realizing some of the damage that they may be causing to them or to the people around them who cared about them. So there's that side of it as well.
Yeah. And I've read that 29% of adults feel comfortable talking about drinking with their family, and around 24% feel comfortable talking about it with their friends. And why do you think so few people feel comfortable talking about drinking?
So I think that was specifically for men in their middle years, midlife men. So men who were sort of 45 to 64. And there are a number of reasons for that. But obviously one of them is fear of stigma and blame. Again, across the course of my career, I've seen lots of people who could have talked to the people around them earlier, at an earlier point in their sort of drug or alcohol using pathway. But it is really hard to do that. And so often what happens is people don't reach out and ask for help and support until it is really very severe. And often things have started falling away at that stage. So it might be because they've got in trouble with the law, or it might be because their partner has left them, or the social services are involved with their children or what have you. But actually tackling it at an earlier point may well have made sure that some of that haunting didn't happen. So yeah, it's a difficult topic for people. And I think what we at DrinkAware are keen to use our sort of opportunity to do is to kind of shift that conversation in society. So we would like really to make it much more normal to talk about alcohol and the part it plays in all of our lives, recognizing that, 80% of people drink alcohol. So it's most people have an experience. It is something that it should be okay to talk about. And even if you have never drunk yourself, you will have been impacted potentially by friends, family, and members of the public or public transport system. You know, everyone has had experiences, possible negative, but maybe positive experiences around drinking. And we should be able to talk about that. We should be able as a society to talk about, well, what are some of the nice reasons people drink? There is quite a lot of nice reasons, otherwise no one would do it. But equally, there are risks associated with it. And we should be able to talk in a very sort of neutral and pragmatic way about, what the benefits are and what the costs and the drawbacks are. And some of those drawbacks and costs are not well understood by the public. So we need to do a best job of opening up those conversations. The only way we can do it is by trying to be non-judgmental when we do it.
Yeah. And it reminds me, and probably reminds you as well, maybe, of kind of the change in conversation about mental health. And what would it look like if society, as a society, we were able to shift to a more open conversation about alcohol? How would that benefit society?
Exactly. So that's very much the inspiration that we are drawing from at DrinkAware, which is to say, we've seen a societal shift over the course of the last 15 odd years where people are now more willing to talk openly about mental health issues, whether it's depression, anxiety, PTSD, phobias, work-related stress. People are more willing to talk openly to their employer about that sort of thing, or indeed their friends and family, medical professionals, etc. So what would it be like if we were able to do that where it comes to alcohol? What would it be like if when you felt able to open up a conversation with a family member or a loved one about your own worry about your drinking, or indeed if you're worried about somebody else? And what we know is that when people do have those conversations, they nearly always go a little bit better than people expect. So it's and actually often spurs people into action as well. So it's not that it can't work, but there are some hints and tips about how and when to have those conversations. So don't talk to people when they're in the middle of a drinking session about their drinking. That's not the time. There will be an argument, probably. So pick the right time, pick the right setting. Choose a moment where you're in a slightly more private space. Things like car journeys are good examples, but there's lots of hints and tips about when and how if you do want to talk to someone you care about.
And if someone's struggling with drinking, if someone who's looking out for them wants to kind of mention it to them or ask them about it or have a conversation? Why do some people who maybe do have a problem with drinking get defensive when they're asked about it?
Yeah, so there's sometimes people are not yet ready to acknowledge to themselves that there is an issue. And so, and if you can't acknowledge it to yourself, it's quite hard to acknowledge it to someone else. Yeah. So people are often, would prefer it if it were true that their drinking is fine, and that they aren't as bad as somebody else, is often how it's couched in their minds, which is, I'm not sleeping on a park bench, so I'm fine. I haven't got a problem with alcohol. I'm not an alcoholic. And having a sort of problematic relationship with alcohol is not a binary. Either you do or you don't. It's a continuum, basically. And it's more a question of like, what's the benefit that you are getting out of this relationship and what are the costs? And thinking through what are the things that are not working for you in your relationship with alcohol and totting some of those things up. And often you'll find that quite a lot is not working as a consequence of your relationship with alcohol, whether it's small family arguments, whether it is lack of sleep, whether it is weight gain. It could be raw anger and fury and violence. It could be, just not having fun on a night out where previously you were. So there's a lot of things that people don't necessarily think of, short-term things that may be not working for them in their relationship with alcohol, as well as the long-term health harms and costs around things like, blood pressure, heart damage, issues in terms of brain, and damage to the brain, cancer, liver disease. There's a lot of long-term health harms that are associated with alcohol consumption too.
And as we're speaking of long-term, is there a kind of predictable pattern throughout someone's lifetime where they slowly become maybe more addicted and more habituated to alcohol, in the sense that I know a lot of people start drinking from a young age, maybe to fit in socially, and then maybe over time they start drinking at home by themselves. Is there kind of a predict? Have you guys kind of found a predictable kind of trajectory that ends up happening? Like, why does it start?
No, I don't think so. So there are a number of theories about why and how people end up in a problematic relationship with a substance, and it's the biopsychosocial model, basically. So there is some question about, are there genetic predispositions? There are some questions about, what are the experiences you've had when you're growing up? Are you surrounded by people who are using drugs or alcohol in a problematic way? You know, what were the behaviors that your parents were exhibiting classically? And then there is a sort of social side, which is, well, what are the people around you doing? What looks like normal in your friendship group or in the people that you spend time with? And for each of us, there are different things that may be more of the sort of underlying set of drivers about why that is. So sadly, no, there isn't a clear pattern about why somebody would go from doing this at the age of 17, 18 to this set of experiences at 35 or 50. Mm. It's not as straightforward as that.
Yeah.
If only it worked.
Yeah. And I was just wondering what the alcohol harm paradox is and why does it happen?
So the alcohol harm paradox is, I'm not very good at remembering the alcohol harm paradox, if I'm honest, but basically the alcohol harm paradox is it's when you're looking at population level harm and where it occurs. And actually what we see, if you look at population level data, is that more alcohol harm is concentrated in areas of lower socioeconomic status. And so it tends to be that in poorer or less well-served communities, that alcohol harm is more severe and more impactful, both to individuals and to communities than it is in wealthier locations. However, if you look at the quantum of how much people drink more in wealthier areas, right? So the sort of middle class, middle aged people classically would perhaps be more likely to be drinking at an increasing risk level across that group. So, and there are more people in poorer areas who choose not to drink at all because they don't have the funds to do so. So when alcohol harm is happening, people are impacted by it more in areas of lower socioeconomic growth because the support around them, the sort of the other networks around that set of people are not as good. So slightly less easy access to healthcare, often not enough, fewer family support mechanisms. People aren't able to step in and help or find you a legal representative. Perhaps if you're a wealthy person and you have a problem with alcohol and you get arrested, you may have someone who can recommend a solicitor to you. If you're in a poorer area, you might not have that same set of choices. And it's that. So it's a kind of population level conundrum, basically.
Yeah.
Doesn't instantly make sense, but actually fewer people drinking in areas of deprivation, but the harm is actually higher.
Mm. And why is catching people before they get into deep more important, like better, rather than waiting for their lives to fully unravel?
Well, so there's a number of answers to that question. So one's there's a moral argument, right? Which is why would we wait for the problem to become really severe before we act? Which is probably the most important one as far as I'm concerned, which is it's our responsibility. As a society, we all should own some of our responsibility to kind of intervening and getting in earlier with people, whether you're, you know, people that work in the industry, members of the public, family and friends, healthcare. We should all be doing more if we can to kind of, you know, notice at an earlier point and try and offer the right kind of help and support. So there's definitely a moral case. There's also an economics case. So alcohol, when things are more problematic, there's around 1 million alcohol-related hospital admissions per year, for example. That's expensive. Around 10,000 people a year pass away because of alcohol-specific causes. So that would be classically things like liver disease, cirrhosis, and that is, and people die a lot younger than in our imagination. So they tend to be in the mid-50s. So it's a not a pleasant way to go. So from a humane point of view, it's not like no one would wish that on anybody. But equally, it's expensive for the healthcare infrastructure in the country. So there's a moral case, there is a financial case, and there is a sort of, I guess there's a, it's just a, it's a classic case. Why would one do prevention rather than cure? And it's both that moral case and that, the economic case as well, really. And it just feels like common sense. The thing that's difficult about it is that if you're in that sort of intervening early preventing landscape, it is proportionally harder to demonstrate your impact, because if you've stopped a thing from ever happening, that's harder to capture and measure than if something has happened or gone wrong and then it has been resolved or mended or fixed in some way.
Yeah, wisdom is prevention, and people get more of a pat on the back from saving someone in an extreme scenario than preventing it in the first place, which is, yes.
Exactly. And I think, and which goes back to the thing of like, as if, you know, in my time of being a frontline worker, your job is to be the support and the person at the back of it. You're not a savior. If you're spending an hour a week with that person and then they get on and turn their lives around, it's not the hour a week that did it. It's that person that did it. And you just happen to be part of that journey, but you're not the savior. And if people are in the space of thinking that they are, then yeah, they probably need to go and talk to their support system and their clinic supervisor around it, I would say.
Yeah. And what are the chances of someone whose life has fully has unraveled, fully making a full recovery? Is that a really low percentage or?
And it's a much better percentage than people think, basically. So people who have ended up in a space where they are in active addiction, the treatment services that are out there that are free. So everywhere in the UK has free drug and alcohol services available. And they're easy to get to in the sense that there are very short waiting times. More, it's certainly easier to get in a drug and alcohol treatment service than the dentist. So, you know somebody who does need formal treatment and support, so psychological help or clinical support and prescribing, those services are there. If their success rates are a lot better than people think, and particularly for alcohol. So when people do go, they've got a really good chance of recovering, if not for a period of time, then permanently. The challenge is that it's only around 1 in 5 people with a dependent relationship with alcohol who actually go to those services. So what the recovery rate would be if everyone was accessing them might be slightly different. But again, there is a finite amount of resource, and actually there are more people out there that need that help and support. So further investment in treatment is something I would always be encouraging.
And you mentioned kind of it's not because of you. If you're there 1 hour a week, that they change their life around, it's on them. That makes me think and want to ask what percentage roughly do you think it is down to personal will and kind of agency in that person compared to maybe other people helping or kind of charities trying to help? Is it a 50-50 or is it?
It's a huge combination of different things, and it will be different for each different person. So as a worker, you might have an hour a week with that person, but they will probably also be doing other things. So they might be going to peer support. So that might be something like AA or NA, which people often do multiple times in a week. So they'd be listening to other people's experiences and stories and hints and tips about what works. It might also be that they're engaged in other sort of meaningful activity to fill up the time that was previously taken up by drinking or by using substances, which again is certainly as people are sort of in that early stage of recovery, that's part of the challenge, which is, well, what do I do now? Who am I now? If this isn't what I do, what is it I do? And trying to have to re-find their own sense of identity and the things that they actually enjoy and don't enjoy, because you have to, as somebody moving towards recovery, work out what gives you meaning and what gives you joy and have like fun and a lovely spirit. Like, there's no point in nobody wants to move to recovery just to kind of sit at home and watch daytime TV and do nothing. You've got to kind of build a new life for yourself. So in terms of what percentage it is about what other people do and what people do themselves, I genuinely have no, I don't know. And I think it's very different for different people. So I'm sure some people will feel very clearly that they wouldn't have been able to do it were it not for a particular doctor or a particular counselor or therapist. Whereas for others, they will be very clear that this was their journey and that they will have encountered a number of people, professionals across the course of that journey, but really it was them. And my view is it's that, but you need to, I think unless you've been through it or you've seen people go through it, like, it's not just willpower, right? Because willpower is a small and finite resource. It's a whole bunch of stuff that goes on. So it's changing the setting. It's changing the social network. It's changing almost your sort of fundamental sense of who you are. That's why it's such a huge and impressive shift for people to make.
Yeah, and what are some common ways people find meaning after they stop drinking? What are some common activities that they tend to do that replaces or tries to mitigate their habit instead of drinking?
If you want to start your own podcast but have no idea where to start, and you want to generate viral social media clips and get your dream guests onto your show, even from just using your laptop in your bedroom like I did, then my Pro Remote Podcast Blueprint is exactly for you. It is a private paid course and community that has every single step and process I've used and continue to use to grow this show. And I include every single secret, every single tactic I do and still use that will get you results super fast. And also, if you want to access me personally every single week, then as part of this course, you'll also be able to join live weekly calls where I go through your podcast and answer your questions to get you results much, much faster. So if you want to actually start a podcast and stop dreaming and get millions of social media views and book your dream guests in half the amount of time it took me, then click the first link in the description. Let's get on to the rest of this episode.
Again, it's very much dependent on the individual. I would say for quite a lot of people, there's some kind of mental health or trauma that has gone alongside their sort of substance issues. So people often need to do things to kind of tackle that. So psychological help usually or of some kind, but also it's Five Ways to Wellbeing type stuff, which is basically taking up physical exercise, being outside, trying new things, building new social networks. So there's a sort of range of things that, you know, a decent service will help people test and try. So for some people, you know, going to the allotment twice a week that maybe they've never done before and actually sort of being in nature is the thing that keeps them going. For other people, it might be, you know, securing a job or volunteering. For some people, it is wanting to use their experiences to help those around them and kind of taking up that kind of peer support role. But very varied. Like, humans are really varied and different. And I think the things that work are similarly varied and different. But what a good service does, and the worker does, is provide a whole range of different options and a menu really of choices for people to test and try out. And not assume that the allotment is definitely going to be the thing that works for you. Because it wouldn't for me, but it will for some.
Yeah. And how important is a change of environment over the long term? I've kind of read the wisdom or the maxim that a change in environment equals a change in behavior. Is that really dependent on the person and dependent on how strong the addiction is?
I think it is pretty important if you have had a very problematic relationship with alcohol. I think if you are somebody who, you know, who drink aware would be thinking about, so somebody who's perhaps drinking at increasing risk levels, but has not got to that more problematic, high harm dependent level. You know, so the vast majority of people who drink below the chief medical officer's guidelines of 14 units a week, and they have several days in the week where they don't drink. But for about 1 in 5 people, they are drinking over that amount. And for most people, they are not the people that with that very high level of harm happening. And so for those people, do you need to change environment if you're drinking 50 units a week, say, and you'd rather be drinking a lower amount of 30 units a week? No, you don't. Do you need to change some of the things that you do and be more conscious of your drinking and perhaps start recording how much you drink, talking to friends and family about your goals and aspirations and ambitions about cutting back? Yes, you do. So, not, you know, there are things that you need to do, but do you need to move house? No, of course you don't need to move house. Do you want to think about where you store the alcohol in your house and maybe move it from being in a line of sight to in a cupboard, at the back of a cupboard, or not even in the house at all? Maybe you do.
Yeah, even doing a little thing like moving the location is important. And even when I'm just doing emails or doing work for the show, if I put my phone behind my laptop so I can't see it,
yeah,
it's way less distracting. Obviously, it's completely different to alcohol. And if you're addicted, it's But it's not the same, but also
it is the same in lots of ways. So small behaviors can add up to big gains in terms of any change that we want to make in our lives. And as you say, it can be as simple as don't leave your half bottle of wine out on the worktop, put it somewhere else. If you've got alcohol free, put that in front of the fridge. Whatever it is that you, or stop buying alcohol-free products instead. So small shift for the vast majority of us can help us cut back the number of units a week that we drink, because we often don't think very hard about how many units a week we drink in the first place. And so taking a bit more notice, recording it and being honest with yourself. So downloading an app, so the Drinkaware app would be a great way of like just counting. And the only person that's ever going to know is you. It doesn't, nobody else is going to see your information. So take a week or 2 weeks or a month and record. And by noticing, you might find you shift your behavior because you realize, actually, there's quite a lot of empty calories that I've drunk in the last few weeks. It might be about how much money you've spent that you didn't think you were spending, as well as the actual, other things that might be going on in terms of increased pressure on your body, lack of sleep, arguments, not following through with your commitments to those that you care about.
Yeah, and big things start small. And if you just start on a small step, that decreases the activation energy for you to start that habit. And the more small things you do, the more it compounds. And then by the time, a few months and a few years later, you've dramatically decreased the amount you drink.
About your own patterns as well. So why is it you're drinking? What's the purpose here? Are you drinking because it's a lovely celebration and a social situation? Brilliant. Are you drinking because it's Friday night and the television's on and that's what you always do? That's a different question. Are you drinking because you are worried, frustrated, you can't pay the bills, that you're struggling to cope? That's another reason. So the reason that are spurring you to drink, those are some of the things to think about. And then think about, are there easy steps you can take to shift behaviors in a way that doesn't feel that difficult? So, if it's a Friday night, could you swap out and have a low and no product instead? If you're in a social circle, you might say, actually, I'm fine. I like this. I'm happy. Or you might say, what I'd like to do is cut back a little bit, and I'm going to talk to my friends and family about how to do that.
Yeah, and how do we define addiction? Because we're mentioning just quite common behaviors, like just drinking on a Friday night in front of TV. How many people do that? Does that count as a problem? Or does it, again, depend on the person?
I am not going to get into the topic of how we define addiction. I am not an addiction specialist. Although I've worked in this space for a very long time, but there are a range of different philosophical and medical explanations. There is a set of diagnostic tests that one would take. What for the people that I'm really interested in, and the people who aren't in that category, which is there are about 8-9 million people who are drinking increasing risk levels but are not in active addiction, but maybe one day might be, unless they're noticing a bit more. And so it's for that group that Drinkaware is really interested in. That's our area of focus, which is basically about 1 in 5 drinkers. And so actually it's much more about step one really is knowing what the guidelines are, which is 14 units a week. So that's not 14 drinks a week, although it might be tempting to want it to be. So that's about 6 pints of beer or 6 medium glasses of wine across the week. And ideally, people would have around 3 days a week of not drinking. You obviously wouldn't want people who are pregnant or thinking of becoming pregnant to be drinking. And also, we would recommend that children don't drink at all. So that's the kind of basics. But then the next question is, what's drinking doing for you? What are the pros and cons of it? And take steps like noticing, recording, just to kind of connect it more with your own relationship with alcohol.
Okay. So what would your answer be to the people who criticize Drinkaware for its supposed lack of independence and industry funding? What would your answer to that be?
So my view, I think, is that alcohol is part of society. So we can pretend, if we want, that big whole businesses don't exist, but they do. And actually, what the public believe, as far as I'm aware, is that business does have some responsibility to tackle alcohol harm. And Drinkaware is one of the ways that that happens. Is it the only way? Is it the only solution? Is it the only way that we can come and tackle this issue? No, of course it isn't. But it is a huge strength of the organization that we have relationships across industry, but also across government and also wider civil society, because actually alcohol should be treated as a shared problem in our society, and everyone has a part to play, including industry and business, and actually encouraging those businesses who want to do the right thing to do the right thing more often is really important. And potentially for us, business retailers are, there's a huge opportunity that comes from that. So if we can be communicating with the public at the point that they are sitting in the pub, or at the point that they are on the aisle in the supermarket, thinking about and making decisions about their relationship with alcohol, that's a huge opportunity. So I think it's a really valid way of tackling alcohol harm. Of course, I don't think it's the only way.
Yeah. And it makes sense to have the government and the actual companies that are selling the product to be involved with the charity. If you were separate, it maybe you'd have less influence over that and less cooperation.
Yeah, and I think from our perspective, it's a relatively unique way of coming at the issue. But for me, it genuinely is a strength that's saying, in order to sort of move and shift relationships and the way that we think about alcohol as a society, you actually need everyone in the conversation. You know, the alcohol industry and retail, who make quite a bit of money as well, they employ an awful lot of people across the UK, and there are opportunities to talk directly to the public. These businesses spend a lot of time and money thinking carefully about their brands, and to be able to kind of help shape messages and make sure that we are doing the best we can to encourage people to have more information to make better decisions. That's really important. But it is also important that we are opening up discussions and conversations with those businesses to try to encourage social trends to be going in the right direction. And that could be around, you know, so if you look at something like drink driving, it would be a really great example. You know, there is a legislative position there about what's you know, it's not allowed. You can go to prison. You can have a very severe fine if you undertake drink driving. But you also want the local pub to have designated driver schemes to be offering zero alcohol alternatives to make it easier for people to choose not to drink and drive. So, you know, to tackle a big social problem and to shift a trend, which once upon a time, drinking and driving was kind of normal, right?
Yeah.
It is now socially unacceptable. And that is a whole range of different parts of our society coming together and saying, we need to do something about this. And it would have been less effective, in my view, had it not been a whole system thinking together about the problem.
Mm. It's better to have multiple ways of tackling the problem than just one. It needs to be a more holistic kind of approach.
Absolutely. And I think it's about recognizing that different charities and organizations are in different places in that system as well. And I'm really supportive of, and would love there to be more alcohol charities. I would like this topic to get more attention. It's a huge issue. It impacts on millions of people's lives. There aren't enough organizations thinking about and coming at this challenge.
Yeah. And you mentioned earlier around 8 or 9 million people drink over the recommended health guidelines. How many people do you think are unaware of the long-term health impacts of alcohol out of that amount of people out of the 8 or 9?
Yeah, so I haven't got the exact number in my head, but what I do know is, so that sort of 8 or 9 million people, that is people's self-reported understanding of whether they're drinking above the guidelines. So you should have a healthy dose of skepticism about the exact number, because people mostly underestimate. And certainly it's the case that when you ask people what the guidelines are, they rarely know. So there's an interesting question there. So in terms of whether people know the health harms and costs associated in the long term with alcohol, again, it very much depends on the health harm that you're thinking about. So most people know that alcohol is bad for your liver, for example. They tend not to think it's their liver that's being damaged. It would be somebody else's, which, of course, liver harm can often be happening at much lower levels than we might want to believe. But in terms of the wider health risks and harms, tend not to be that well known about. And that it's a really broad array of issues. So alcohol impacts on loads of different health harms and costs. It's particularly bad for everything on the digestive system. So it's impacts on a number of different cancers. It's not good for heart health. It's interrelated with diabetes, with brain health. So there are a lot of different issues that can be impacted by alcohol, and of course mental health as well, which again people tend not to think. If they're having some kind of issue with their mental health, cutting back on your alcohol consumption might actually make quite a big difference.
Yeah, because I had someone else on the show who used to be addicted to alcohol, and they told me that alcohol is a depressant and a stimulant. So if you're having it before bed, you're going to feel down anyway. You're going to probably feel hungover in the morning, but you're also, it's going to greatly impact your sleep, right? And that's going to have a huge effect on your mental health.
Yeah, exactly. And basically there are short-term things that alcohol does to you on, you know, the day after, as you're drinking, the day after you're drinking, and maybe the day after that, dependent on, you know, what's gone on for you and the way that your body responds to alcohol. But then there are long-term health harms and costs as well of that pattern of behavior over a longer period of time. And both are important. And actually people often find, because alcohol and sleep is a huge thing, it's not simply that you wake up in the night and need to go for a wee. It's it disrupts your REM sleep cycle because alcohol's, you know, across the blood-brain barrier, basically. Yeah. And that's why we have memory loss, because that is impacting inside your brain, which, of course, is what the benefits are as well. Otherwise, you wouldn't have the normal positive associations with alcohol. Mm. So, but sometimes it's that short-term stuff. So improved skin, looking lighter and brighter, you weight loss, financial improvements because you're not spending so much money on alcohol. Sometimes it's those things that people find more motivating, partly because it's really hard to think my drinking behavior is going to impact on my likely chances of developing cancer in 40 years' time. That feels so distant.
Yeah.
As to be very unlikely, even though there are risks associated with it. And actually, I think it's 1 in 13 breast cancer cases is linked to alcohol consumption, for example. So there are different risks for men as there are for women.
Yeah, I landed on a Greek island last night, and the coach driver accidentally missed our hotel, and we drove through the party strip, which was a bit out the way, and there were a lot of people my age and younger, so 18 to 20 year olds. It was about midnight, and there were a lot of people clearly under the influence of alcohol, and quite dramatically so. What would your advice be to maybe an 18 to 20 year old person who's starting to drink or is thinking of drinking, or maybe even wants to quit drinking? What would your advice be to that generation?
Well, so I think what I would say is, if you look at all of the generations, younger adults tend to be on average drinking less than previous generations, on average. not necessarily in any individual set of circumstances, as you were describing there. I think the thing that's been really, young adults have been really sort of leading the charge when it comes to low and no alcohol products and demanding mocktails and more choice when they are on nights out, which is fantastic and something to be celebrated. I think it is important for young people to be able to socialize and let their hair down, and important that we recognize that that is fun. So I think really at any age, my thoughts and advice would be much the same, which is make sure you've got all the right information when you're thinking about your own relationship with alcohol, and think about what are the things that are positive about it, what you're getting out of it that's positive, but also think about what are the harms and costs in the short term. So as we said, things like sleep, mental health, etc., but also some of the risks in the long term, particularly for younger adults. Our brain are continuing to develop up until about the age of 25. So, you know, if your brain health is important to you, which kind of should be, have a think about that as one of the things that maybe we don't talk about often enough. So there's a reason why we don't let children drink alcohol, and brain health is one of those reasons.
Yeah. And if drink aware could make one lasting change for society, what would it be?
Well, that's a big question. I would really love if Drink Aware can help shift the societal conversation around alcohol. And if I could work a magical spell to shift moderate, low-risk drinking to be really cool and aspirational, that would be my goal. Because if we could get that 1 in 5... to be 1 in 20 people drinking above the guidelines, because that's just not what people do. That would be amazing.
Yeah, that would be very amazing. And a few ending questions. If you had one piece of advice to your 20-year-old self, what would it be?
This is the sort of thing I have to think about in advance. I think, my 20-year-old self. I don't know. I think I would say that working in this space is really fulfilling, and that it's a long journey. Right, it's hard to shift and change patterns, but that doesn't mean it's not worth a go.
Yeah. Karen Tyrrell, ladies and gentlemen, I really appreciate that you're trying to shift this and make it 1 in 20 people drinking below the guidelines. I really appreciate what you and Drinkware are doing for society. What are you currently working on, and where can people go if they want to check out more of your work?
So people can go to our website, which is drinkaware.co.uk. I'd encourage people to also download our app.
Yeah.
And count your units for a bit, see what happens, see what you find out about yourself and your own relationship with alcohol. We have recently done a campaign targeting midlife men, and we've got some really great videos and stories that talk where individual guys have talked about the fact that their alcohol use maybe got a little bit out of hand, because they were drinking to cope, and that they've managed to get the right kind of conversations going that have helped them cut back. They're still drinking alcohol, but in a much more sort of in a way that's working for them, basically more moderately than before. So there's some great videos that people can watch. Chris Kamara, the footballer, helps us out with that campaign. So if you're a football supporter, please do go and have a look at some of those videos.
Yeah, I love Chris Kamara. I'll leave all the stuff that you just mentioned in the show notes for people to check out below. Thank you for your time. Thank you for coming on the show, and hopefully speak to you in the future.
No problem.
If you got to the end of this video, then you're literally in the top 1% of minds on the planet. You're curious, you love podcasts, and you love this show, but you also probably want to start your own show as well. And this is the exact same position I was in about a year or two ago, where I consumed so many podcasts and loved every second of it. But in the back of my mind, there was always that thought, huh, I want to start my own show. But the problem was all these podcasters that I listened to didn't have a step-by-step blueprint that would help me avoid the mistakes that they've made and create my own pro show like the ones that I listened to from them in a fast amount of time. Luckily for you, I've solved this problem for you. I've created my step-by-step pro remote podcast blueprint for the kind of person who wants to start a podcast from scratch but has no idea of what equipment to use, how to find guests, how to actually record it, even on their laptop if they live in the middle of nowhere and don't have a studio, which, let's be real, most of you probably don't have and you don't actually need, and want to grow their show fast, generate viral social media clips, and actually turn podcasting into not just a dream, but a genuine career that they can make money from. So if you're interested in this, it is literally a video course that goes through every single step and process that'll get you from no idea of how to start a show, no idea how podcasting works, to a pro remote podcaster who has the potential to generate viral social media clips and get their dream guests on their show in a matter of weeks. And as well as the video course, you'll also be able to join live weekly calls with me, where I'll go through your show and give you personalized feedback of how to improve to get you results much faster. You'll also get access to the AI email templates, the AI research templates, the title and thumbnail templates I use to get super high personality guests, super high performing guests, and at a really, really good conversion rate. A lot of the emails I send do end up getting yeses for people coming onto the show, as well as generate super engaging thumbnails and titles, and also generate viral social media clips. For example, one of my social media clips got 1 million+ views on Instagram and TikTok, the same clip. So this is proof that it works. And if you want to get all of this and genuinely become a pro podcaster super fast, even from your bedroom, then this is for you. And alongside my templates, you'll also get an ebook, which goes into even more detail about not just my show and how to create your own pro show, but also other successful shows and the tactics that they do to blow up on social media and generate a loyal audience that they can actually teach, but also make a career from as well. So if you're interested, then it's the first link in the description. You won't regret it. I know you've been dreaming of creating a podcast your entire life, or for at least a year, 6 months. And this is the best opportunity you're going to get. And I don't know any other pro podcaster that I listen to, that I love, that has a step-by-step blueprint of the exact things they do to grow and continue to succeed at their show. So this is the once-in-a-lifetime opportunity for you right now. It might have changed if you're watching this a few months later, but right now you can get the founder's pre-sale price. And basically, once 25 members join the community, the price will double. And also, if you don't feel satisfied with the course and with the community, and you have followed all the steps, taken all the notes, taken all the action, and if you don't feel like you're at least 5 times more confident at podcasting and don't have a remote pro show all set up and ready to get your dream guests on to your show and create a super awesome podcast, then I'll give you your money back, no questions asked. So if you're interested, first link in the description, your future self will thank you. I'll hopefully see you there. Goodbye.